Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
I think it's a bleak day for Americans because this is just one more divisive issue, and we're such a deeply divided country.
Congresswoman Peltola speaks about former President Trump's indictment. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 4th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, King Cove is stuck using bottled water since city wells tested high for PFAS.
Finding out about the PFAS has been scary for me as someone who's been drinking the water for 20 years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's 3 universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Congresswoman Mary Peltola declined again today to pass judgment on the case against former President Donald Trump.
I personally feel like as a member of the legislative branch, it's not really my place to comment on things in the judicial branch.
Peltola spoke from Anchorage today on Talk of Alaska. Trump pleaded not guilty to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Peltola says she trusts that the case against Trump will be decided fairly in court, but she says the loud ruckus outside the court today discouraged her.
I think it's a bleak day for Americans because this is just one more divisive issue, and we're such a deeply divided country.
2 callers to Talk of Alaska asked about gun violence and banning assault rifles. Peltola reiterated her support of the Second Amendment. She says she's open to solutions, but is leery of supporting bills that don't have a chance of passing. On Sunday, Juneau police arrested Mitchell Whatley in connection with anti-trans and threatening notes posted around town. Whatley is widely known as the illustrator of the popular Alaska children's book, I Would Tuck You In. He's being charged with terroristic threatening, a felony. Juneau police were able to use Costco's surveillance video to track the person who posted notes there back to a car. They then traced the license plates on the car to Whatley, who allegedly confessed. Lieutenant Craig Campbell with the Juneau Police credited the FBI for helping with the arrest.
You know, anytime there's a potential threat like this and it comes across, we try to partner with any resources we can. So if any other law enforcement that may be able to aid in this, and the FBI is a partner that a lot of times will assist in these types of cases.
Assistant District Attorney Rexine Finley said Whatley put Juneau residents in fear and intimidated the trans community as well as families with children in schools. Along with setting Whatley's bail at $10,000, a judge required that he hand in all firearms and stay away from schools and parks. Residents in the small Aleutian community of Cold Bay have relied on bottled water for about 10 months, ever since the city's drinking wells tested high for PFAS. PFAS are man-made chemicals commonly found in manufactured goods, which have been linked to adverse health effects like cancer and birth abnormalities. Limits on the chemical compounds have historically been set by individual states. Now, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is proposing a nationwide limit, which has given new life to a conversation in Alaska about limiting PFAS in local water supplies. KUCB's Theo Greenlee reports.
About a year ago, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation tested Cold Bay's water wells for PFAS, and the results came back high, well above the levels allowed for human consumption. So the city closed the wells for drinking, and the community has been on bottled water ever since.
It's something that we thought we never would have to deal with, and here we are dealing with it.
Lori Pierce is the city clerk for Cold Bay's 50 or so residents. She says the state's Department of Transportation has been providing community members with bottled water since the test results came back last June.
So today the water situation is that we can only use our city water for doing laundry, taking showers, anything that does not involve ingesting. So if you're ingesting water, using it to cook or to drink with, then you need to use the bottled water that's being supplied.
PFAS are often referred to as forever chemicals because they don't break down in the environment and because they build up cumulatively in the body. They're popular in manufacturing because they're extremely durable, they repel water and heat, and they're used in things like carpet and upholstery, waterproof clothing, and nonstick cooking pans. In Cold Bay, the chemicals likely leached into the water from a firefighting foam called aqueous film-forming foam, or AFFF. The foam is known to contain two kinds of PFAS, but many airports use it because it is extremely effective at extinguishing fuel fires, a major hazard at airports. Sammy Cummings is the PFAS program manager for DOT's Statewide Aviation Division. She says that up until a few years ago, the Federal Aviation Administration required airports to test the foam annually, typically by spraying it onto the runway.
What the requirement is they test their proportioning systems annually, which would have required a discharge into the environment every year to prove to the FAA inspector that all systems are working and operating. And that's just to ensure should a accident or emergency event happen that requires the use of foam, that their systems are ready.
AFFF foams were first developed in the 1960s, and they quickly became the gold standard. And Cummings says the Federal Aviation Administration has required certain airports to use the foams since the 1970s.
People want to know why we are still using it, and that's because that it's a federal requirement for airports to carry AFFF, because AFFF with PFAS is the best at what it does.
She says the FAA is looking into alternatives, and she expects them to announce new requirements this year. Cold Bay is not the first Alaska community to find PFAS due to that firefighting foam. Gustavus, Yakutat, and Dillingham have experienced similar situations. But the situation in Cold Bay is a little different. According to Mayor Candace Nielsen, that's because the city relies completely on public wells.
We are a unique community with this problem because other communities have also found PFAS contamination in their drinking sources, but our community is been the only one in the state so far that we all are served off of the city well, and so individuals don't have separate well systems. We're all getting our water from the city well.
Ingesting contaminated water doesn't automatically mean you'll experience negative health outcomes. It can take decades for the compounds to build up in the body, making it difficult to link them to negative health consequences. The wells in Cold Bay were drilled in 1993. 30 years ago. And that's alarming for longtime residents like Mayor Nielsen.
Finding out about the PFAS has been scary for me as someone who's been drinking the water for 20 years. It's not going to affect somebody that comes in a Cold Bay today and drinks a glass of the water. But just the fact that I've been here for so long and I've been consuming it, it was very alarming, and it's still, you know, it's a lingering thought in my mind of what potential issues can I have down the road just because we didn't know until now.
The DOT contracted with a third party to create a feasibility study for Cold Bay. That'll determine if they drill a new well or install a filtration system. Representatives from the department did not give an estimated timeline, but say they'll continue providing bottled water to Cold Bay until they find a permanent solution. Reporting from the Aleutians, I'm Theo Greenlee.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a North Pole man receives a long-awaited heart transplant.
Now we can look forward to 10 years together, 20, 30.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
A North Pole man who was delayed by bad weather on his way to Seattle for a heart transplant in December finally received a new heart over the weekend. As KUAC's Robin reports, Patrick Holland had moved to Seattle to await the life-saving surgery.
Haley Holland spent the last 4 days in and out of University of Washington Medical Center watching over her husband, Patrick. She says he got a call late Thursday telling him a heart was available.
Now we can look forward to 10 years together, 20, 30. I joke about wanting to see our 45th wedding anniversary.
The Hollands were married in 2006. They have 4 children together, all of whom were able to fly down on Friday while Patrick was in the OR.
We landed at 7 o'clock in the morning. We landed like 15 minutes early. And at like 7:06, the surgeon calls me and says that surgery's done.
This was long-awaited news. The 57-year-old Holland has had congestive heart failure since his late 20s. 3 years ago, doctors told him he needed a transplant. Alaskans learned Holland's story last winter. He got a call December 22nd from UW Med Center that a heart was a perfect match and waiting for him in Seattle. He and his brother boarded a plane out of Fairbanks early the next morning, but it was diverted from Seattle by a terrible ice storm, and the plane turned around and landed in Anchorage. Holland had to let that heart go to another person on the transplant list. That week, he decided to move to Seattle.
Because I don't want to ever miss another chance. It's just not going to happen.
Holland has been living with a couple in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood close to the hospital for the last 3 months, while Haley and the kids stayed in North Pole. He's tried to keep active.
You know, he came down here and got a part-time job working with clients with severe dementia. That's just what he has a heart for.
Since January, there were 3 times when he was called to the transplant center to receive a new heart, but they all fell through. Once before in March, Haley and the kids flew in, only to hear that the operation would not happen.
We have been completely knocked askew with every aspect of our life.
Since Patrick's successful transplant, Haley has been able to visit twice a day and has had the children, aged 4 to 17, in one or two at a time. She's learning what comes next.
It has just been replaced by a different uncertainty. Getting a heart transplant is replacing one disease with another.
She says she knows some patients don't live to recover. There are rejections and complications.
That's the life that we're facing now.
Patrick won't be coming home to North Pole for several months.
He'll be in the ICU or the hospital recovery rooms for 3 to 4 weeks.
Then to a recovery facility called Transplant House for occupational and physical therapy and cardiac rehabilitation. Haley Holland anticipates being in Seattle about 2 more weeks for this trip.
There is nothing different about being here from being at home in terms of laundry and dishes and feeding the kids and occupying their time. Having the kids with me is probably the only thing keeping me from turning into a puddle of tears. I'm making sure that this is an adventure for them and not a traumatizing experience.
She says she has much to be thankful for and reminds people to register as organ donors. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
The start of Alaska's cruise ship season is just 2 weeks away. In a recent interactive feature for Hakai magazine, freelance investigative journalist Andrew Angelson took a look at the impact the cruise industry has on the environment and quality of life in Southeast Alaska. KTOO's Anna Canny talked to him about his findings.
These are floating hotels that have up to 4,000 people on them. And so those people are, you know, brushing their teeth and using showers. And so there's going to be treated sewage, gray water, all the trash that's generated, and, you know, thousands of tourists basically doubling or tripling the size of population of small towns when these ships arrive. But I wanted to dig in deeper. And so I spoke to the magazine that published it, Hakai, about how we could approach that.
Here in Juneau, something that really struck me is that the majority of our marine emissions, I think upwards of 80%, can be linked to the diesel fuel that burns with cruise ships. But I'm wondering if you could contextualize that piece a little bit more for me.
Yes, it was really surprising because I think a lot of us, you know, we're always thinking about our climate impacts, about, you know, whether we drive our car on a trip or if we take a flight, and, you know, where cruises fit into that as well. And cruises seem to be really high on that level. And that was fairly surprising to see that one, 7-day cruise was putting out, you know, 2,800 metric tons of carbon dioxide, which is equivalent to driving 600 cars for a year.
And another thing I want to ask about, those diesel fuels are really heavy on emissions, but they're also heavy on another kind of pollution, which I wasn't super familiar with. It's the impact of scrubber discharge.
Yeah, so a lot of these ships for years used what's called high sulfur fuel, and it puts out these particulates. It's really bad pollution. And so the International Maritime Organization, you know, recommended that ships either switch to a low sulfur fuel or put in what's called a scrubber, which basically sprays water through the exhaust and basically taking that and putting those pollutants into the water instead of into the air. The problem is then it takes those pollutants and puts it out into the sea. And so that discharge is very acidic. It contributes to ocean acidification. It has, metals and other pollutants in it. And it's really very unregulated because it's relatively new. I mean, most people know about, you know, sewage and that it should be treated. But this is dumped in both Washington State, British Columbia, and Alaska.
It's clear from a lot of the sources that you interview that there's definitely concern. Like, Alaskans are concerned and are noticing these impacts. But there's a trade-off for a lot of these communities, right? You hear about the economic benefit that the cruise industry brings.
Yeah, it's a complicated issue. I mean, you know, Seattle actually definitely benefits. There's no question. And certainly it's, you know, the economic benefits to places like Juneau and Ketchikan are high. And maybe the economic benefits are, you know, worth it. But when you kind of total up, you know, all of those impacts and the impacts to quality of life, you know, there's some question. And it was surprising to me that there was a poll of Juneau residents that said a majority of them were like, yes, we should limit the number of cruise ships.
Andrew Engelson wrote about the environmental impact of the cruise industry for Hakai Magazine, and he spoke with KTOO's Anna Canny.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska. The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Trawl nets, buoys, even boats and fragments of buildings, these are some types of marine debris that wash up on Alaska's coasts every day. Lauren Devine is director of the Ecosystem Conservation Office on the remote Bering Sea island of St. Paul. She says it's a never-ending problem for her community.
In one cleanup with a crew of about 10 people on St. Paul Island in any given year, we can pull about 20,000 or more pounds of debris in a week off of our shorelines.
Devine spoke at a marine debris panel at the Arctic Encounter Conference in Anchorage last week. She says the trash piling up on St. Paul's beaches tends to be big, heavy pieces of fishing gear. Coordinating teams to collect and sort the debris, plus a barge to pick it up and take it to a landfill on the mainland, is an expensive logistical nightmare.
All of the time, the burden for these cleanups is put on the communities.
Funding these efforts is a major challenge. NOAA supplies some grants to fund cleanup efforts, and an Anchorage-based environmental nonprofit has helped to coordinate pickups all over Alaska. But overall, coordinators say there's not enough money to address the scale of the problem. There's also not a clear way to hold anyone responsible for the trash that washes up on shore. NOAA fisheries biologist Erica Amon says, as shipping traffic increases off Alaska's coasts and the mariculture industry expands, the focus should be on preventing marine debris at its source.
I think now is the time to, you know, make sure that we have regulations or permitting requirements in place so that they don't contribute to the problem.
Amon says NOAA is helping start a marine debris action plan for Alaska to educate rural cleanup coordinators and connect them with resources. She's also hoping the 2021 bipartisan infrastructure law will help make more money available to fund marine debris cleanup. Federal fisheries managers are meeting in Anchorage this week to talk about Cook Inlet commercial fishing and salmon bycatch, among other big-ticket agenda items. Alaskans behind the Skipper Science app say they'd like to see more local and indigenous voices at the forefront of these conversations, and they see their program heading into its third season as one way to do so. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Skipper Science has been around since 2021. Fishermen who use it log observations about marine weather and mammal sightings, as well as any other fisheries patterns or changes they notice while they're out at sea. This year, the app's creators are hoping to formalize that data collection process more so they have more concrete on the water information to hand to managers making decisions about their fisheries. Hannah Marie Garcia is a coordinator with the Aleut community of St. Paul Island, the tribal government that developed the app.
The fishermen tend to be a little bit left out, and there is kind of this mystery a little bit in terms of fisheries management and how that can be, you know, an open door for our observers.
The Aleut community of St. Paul Island's been working on the technology for years. In 2021, it joined forces with the Juneau-based nonprofit Salmon State to launch the app. Since then, they've gathered two fishing seasons worth of observations. At least 10 reports last season came from fishermen in Cook Inlet. Lindsay Bloom with Salmon State says those observations provide important local context to complex and controversial fishing decisions.
Skipper Science is a way to bring the perspectives of local-based, Alaska-based small boat fishermen into the process where we do have challenges with representation.
Local and Indigenous representation has long been a sticking point for the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which makes decisions about fishing in Alaska's federal waters. None of the group's members today represent tribal entities. Last month, Governor Mike Dunleavy's appointment to the council drew criticism from tribal and subsistence fishing advocates, who said his choice to nominate another council member with roots in the pollock industry was disappointing. At its meeting this week, the council is considering a hard cap on chum salmon bycatch, which could have implications for small boat fishermen in western Alaska. As it stands, fishermen who aren't on the council are largely left to weigh in the public comment portion of the meeting. Garcia says they'd like to push that further.
We're now working on pathways to include, you know, our observations and our data summaries into the report that do land in front of the Fisheries Management Council staff as an update.
She says they're designing research methods alongside federal fishing managers to collect data from the deck to better understand the health and ecology of the fisheries. In 2022, she says they collected over 24 samples from black cod to learn more about what the fish were eating.
So that's like a specific fleet and a specific group of people that we tapped into that are involved in our network that aren't just reporting general observations.
This year, they're hoping to collect data on water temperature from sensors attached to boats in Alaska's oceans. Bloom also says those kinds of observations can speed up the process of data collection to make it more responsive to the rapid changes happening in Alaska's waters now.
I think what we know now, certainly from my perspective as a fisherman in Alaska, is that we need management that can be a lot more nimble and adaptive in real time than what we're seeing happening at the council. And that is where these thousands of small boats peppered across the ocean, sprinkled across the ocean throughout Alaska, can be incredibly helpful.
Meanwhile, they're looking for more fishermen to get involved with the program this upcoming season. Cook Inlet fishermen who are interested will have a few chances to meet with the Skipper Science team next month. Bloom says they're hosting training sessions in Kenai and Homer in May, with dates to be announced. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The Bethel Native Youth Olympic Invitational was held at Bethel Regional High School this past weekend. KYUK's Francisco Martinez Cuello was in attendance and has this story.
Around 140 student athletes representing Upiat and Lower Kuskokwim school districts filled the high school gymnasium. Between Friday and Saturday, they competed in 10 events. Event organizer Tommy Bayayuk has been the head coach for Bethel Regional High School's NYO for the past 9 years.
Usually we hold our invitational every year right before the district meet, which rotates with the LKSD villages.
Most of the events happened on Friday. That's when students competed in the kneel jump, wrist carry, 2-foot high kick, scissors broad jump, Alaskan high kick, one-foot high kick, one-arm reach, and Eskimo stick pull. Then on Saturday, they competed in the seal hop and Indian stick pull. Each event is designed to test hunting and survival skills, increase strength and maintain endurance, agility, and the balance of mind and body. Take the one-foot high kick, for example. Bayayuk says it's a signal.
The history behind the one-foot is if a hunting group is out and they get big game or whale or something that where they would need lots of help, and a lot of the northern part of Alaska is flat, so you see someone do a one-foot in a distance, that usually means they need help, successful hunt.
More than 15 teams were invited to compete at Bethel's Invitational.
Originally, we were supposed to have over 170, but two sites had to cancel due to weather out on the coast. So I'm guessing we're in the range of 140, 150 student athletes.
The competitors were fourth graders all the way up to high school students.
We usually have two groups. There's a JV, which is the fourth grade to eighth grade. And then we have a varsity level, which is seventh grade to 12th grade. And those are usually the good athletes that try to earn a spot to the state team. And the junior high, seventh and eighth, they're either in JV or varsity. They can switch back and forth.
Top teams received handcrafted wooden plaques along with the top male and female athletes. Ribbons were handed out usually for those placing in first through fifth. Kuwiguluk took the first place prize in junior varsity group. Its athletes took both top athletes awards, with Christopher Lewis winning top male athlete and Bessie David as the top female athlete. Tuntutuliak's team came in second, and Akyuk third. At the varsity level, Bethel Regional High School dominated with a commanding 35-point lead, and its athletes also took both top athletes awards, with Dalen Nelson as the top varsity male and Jordan Kleshka as the top female athlete. Chifornik's team came in second place and Kipnuk in third. But it was Oscarville which received the coveted top sportsmanship award. Bayayuk explains why it holds such value.
The only thing I can really add is just the sportsmanship by all the coaches and teams, where in basketball, you're not going to be helping out another team, where in NYO, I could be giving pointers to a Kuwiguluk kid. The Kipnuk coach can be giving pointers to another village site where it's really good sportsmanship.
The district meet will be held in Nightmute in a couple of weeks. That competition is where LKSD will determine who will be on the team to travel and compete in the statewide competition. At the Warrior Dome in Bethel, I'm Francisco Martinez Cuello.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Yvonne Crumbry and Anna Canny in Juneau, Theo Greenlee in Unalaska, Robin in Fairbanks, Kavitha George in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, and Francisco Martinez Cuello in Bethel. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. If you are experiencing domestic violence or feel unsafe, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is here for you. Call 1-844-762-8483 or visit strongheartshelpline.org. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.